recycle box here, in here?
We're going to open the House Committee on Agriculture and Land Use. Today is April the 2nd, 2019. We are going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3384. Take Representative Wilde's testimony, then we're going to recess that bill temporarily, do all of our work sessions, so my vice chair, who's ill, can not infect people and go home and rest, and then come back to 3384 for our other two testifiers. Then about that time we'll either be moving into lamb and beef, or Speaker Kotek will join us for 2003, depending on how fast we go. So with that, let's hear about House Bill 3384.
Thank you, Chair Clem, Vice Chairs McLean and Post, and members of the Agricultural Land Use Committee. I'm Marty Wilde, representative from House District 11. In 2009, the Oregon legislature passed legislation to allow existing schools on exclusive farm use zones to continue to operate and expand if the land was owned prior to the passage of the act. In 2010, the Land Conservation and Development Commission adopted rules that preclude schools with more than 100 students from expanding. This prevents 10 schools across Oregon from building or expanding at all. One of these schools is Oak Hill in Lane County, which is trying to expand a classroom and lunchroom and build a new theater in its small campus. The EFU land that it is trying to build on is owned by the school and is unsuitable for farming due to poor soil quality and because the land has been committed to educational facilities for almost 30 years. And quite practically, it's between LCC and the freeway, so I'm not sure anybody would want to farm there anyway. House Bill 3384 makes it clear that in statute the school can expand on land they owned before 2009. I ask you to pass House Bill 3384 because it's important to allow these existing schools to continue to operate effectively to meet the needs of their student populations in the surrounding communities. Thank you.
Vice Chair McLean.
Do you know how big your footprint is?
They own 60 acres. The footprint is probably a better question for Mr. Mitke, who's going to follow me.
Okay.
60 acres.
Mr. Mitke, why don't you join us? Our vice chair says he can make it another couple minutes to hear what you have.
I'm just concerned about Representative Helm.
Yes.
He's just getting over it, and I don't want to give it back to him.
That's true.
Thank you for the record. Zach Mitke for Oak Hill School. I'm sorry. Chair Clinton, Vice Chair McLean.
Mr. Chair, the question was, how large is your footprint? How much land do you own there?
Well, the ownership is as Representative Wilde indicated, about 60 acres. The area of the school is actually much smaller. The school itself is only
less than five, certainly.
Yeah, I think the student population is about 200 students or thereabouts. I think we've factored in that with all the outdoor areas that they have for their beehives and things like that, there's somewhere around, I think, 25 acres, including their playing fields and their baseball diamond.
May I ask one question? So you are completely in a rural zone. You are not inside of Oak Ridge or Oak Hill. I mean, Oak Hill is the school. And you are the closest thing to you is a freeway and a community college?
Yeah, we're actually sandwiched between Interstate 5 on one side and Lane Community College on the other side.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
What's the actual name of it? Oak Hill School?
It is Oak Hill School, yes.
Is that considered Eugene or no?
I'm sorry.
Is that considered Eugene?
Probably consider it to be Eugene, but it's outside of Eugene city limits and over a hill and down the road.
Yeah, look it up on Google Maps just so I can see how it's
very
Eldon Schaefer Drive.
Yeah, if you go out East 30th and tease into Interstate 5 out there.
Got it. Oh, yeah, if you'd like to give your testimony as well while I'm
certainly
looking at your school from the sky.
Sure.
All right. I just flew a drone over there right now, actually. Just kidding.
Sorry. Yeah. As indicated, Oak Hill School is a small, independent K-12 school located between Interstate 5 and Lane Community College in the hills south of Eugene. It provides unique educational opportunities for about 200 students. It varies. It can go up or down a little bit. Sort of the greater Lane County area and as far away as Monroe in Benton County, including rural communities like Oak Ridge and Notai, and as well as some urban students and some international students, which they invite into the high school. Oak Hill School emphasizes college preparation, but it also focuses in other areas like STEM and foreign languages, which are available beginning in kindergarten, actually, and an emphasis on its natural setting. I think the second graders get to go out on nature hikes bimonthly. The school has beehives. They have the Russell Creek drainage that drains through the property, and the students are actually actively working on restoration of that wetland out there. Oak Hill School is in the process of celebrating its 25th anniversary, and thanks to a successful fundraising drive, is in a position to replace some aging portable classrooms that have been on the property for the last 25 years with the new theater building. The square footage works out to be about roughly the same, and to add some much needed space, classroom space to one of the other buildings and lunchroom. In total, the square footage is around 10,000 square feet or thereabouts. However, in the last 25 years, Oak Hill School stopped being an outright permitted use on exclusive farm use land. After the 2009 House Bill 3099, Oak Hill School and several other schools throughout the state, as I'm sure you're aware, became a non-conforming use in the property they were located on. Because schools were just not limited to serving the immediate rural area. Fortunately, House Bill 3099 didn't leave Oak Hill School and others like it out in the cold. Recognizing that several schools, particularly I think the schools in the Hood River District, were already located on EFU land outside of the urban growth, outside the UGB, but served urban populations, the legislature adopted ORS 215-135 as a safety valve to allow existing schools in EFU land to expand on their property. This provision incorporated a conditional use permitting process, which allows the county to consider inputs from neighbors and landowners, and to assure compatibility with surrounding farm and forest uses, just like any other conditional use process for non-farm uses on EFU land. In 2017, Lane County used this conditional use approval process when it approved Oak Hill School's proposed expansion. But there was a problem. Following the enactment of ORS 215-135, LCDC had adopted a rule that limited schools to 100 people and required groups of enclosed structures to be one half mile apart if school was located within 3 miles of an urban growth boundary. Through an accident of geography or topography or what have you, Oak Hill School just happens to be located that close to the city of Springfield's urban growth boundary on the far side of I-5. The rules were adopted in response to a different issue. It was actually adopted in response to the Young versus Jackson County case, which dealt with churches and that sort of thing. But Luba looked at it and said, well, it's intended to impose a hard cap of 100 people, and since you've already got more than your 100 people, you're prohibited now, Oak Hill, from expanding ever. The purpose of House Bill 3384 is to restore the safety valve in ORS 215-135. For Oak Hill School and other K-12 schools that are similarly situated. The draft provisions continue to incorporate the conditional use approval standards of the original rule at 215-135, which was something of particular importance and concern to the Oregon Farm Bureau, at line 15 of the proposed draft. They continue to apply the requirements of ORS 215-296 as you would with any other conditional use in an EFU zone. And subsection 2 of the rule makes clear that that county is required to deny the school based on the administrative rule that we're talking about, 660-033-0130, I believe, by saying, you know, you're not required to deny on the basis of maximum capacity of people or minimum distance between structures or maximum density of structures. The purpose is just to make sure that neither the administrative rules or the local zoning ordinances that have been adopted based on the administrative rules prevent the expansion of these existing schools on EFU land. Based on a review of impacted districts, we believe the proposal will benefit Oak Hill School and well, as one of 10 existing, at least K through 12 schools in at least 8 districts across the state. In addition to our testimony today, we've been asked to write a letter of support from the superintendent of schools of the Bensville Pines School District who requests relief for their Buckingham Elementary School, which I'll submit at the end of my testimony. In consultation with others, we've incorporated 3 changes, which we've provided, which are in the Dash 1 amendments. Change 1 it's a change number 1 is a change back to the original reference to tax lots. Had been a change to lots or parcels. Lane County was concerned about that. And we want to make sure that we don't have to go through a legal lot verification process every time that anyone wants to expand a school. Change number 2 was to describe schools as public or private school for kindergarten through grade 12. This was at the behest of DLCD, which just wanted to make sure that this rule is consistent with the current 215, 283, and 215, 213. And change number 3 was to add an emergency clause, which was suggested by Senator Beyer, and I think is a good idea. We heard that there are other proposed amendments that are in consideration. We don't have a position on those. As long as they incorporate the Dash 1 amendments, we're fine with them. Thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer any questions that I can with regard to the school.
The first one is, I'm familiar with the school because they have a debate and speech program, which you guys need to support more. But how many students are actually from that, let's say, a 5-mile radius or a 10-mile radius? Do you have any idea?
I don't have a good sense of how many students.
You talked about kids coming all the way from Monroe outside of Corvallis. That's quite a long ways from there.
It is. And I think our proximity to I-5 makes things like that a little bit
and
easier sometimes.
So in my mind, do you guys have buses, or is everybody transported by private family or vehicle?
It's generally through either an individual or through carpooling, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when you talk about, basically about the distance between the buildings, is this theater building going to be a connected building, or are you trying to put it on some other area in the place? Or
It's basically in the midst of existing buildings out there. They may need to relocate a walkway or something like that in order to connect it up. But we're not putting it on the same footprint as the portables, but probably within about 100 yards of where they're located at. Yeah. Just due to the sort of the nature of the topography for the school, it's kind of a flat part on the top of a hill where most everything is located, and then it sort of slopes down into the drainage. So.
And did you see how far you were away from another high school, like either in Springfield or Eugene?
I'm sorry?
At another school, how far away you were from another school like Springfield or Eugene?
Well, I mean, the closest school would be Lane Community College, but I'm not aware of any other proximate schools in that vicinity. I'm trying to think. Probably, if you go up East 30th, I would say somewhere in the neighborhood about 3 to 5 miles. Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you.
So I'm still trying to sort something out. The 215, 235 you mentioned, I think that was in the same bill. It almost sounds like it was done afterwards, but it.
Yeah. 215, 135, Chair Clem, was actually section 14 of that bill, if I recall correctly.
Yeah. The weird thing we're still trying to sort out, I have LC looking at this. This actually applies to, it was meant to apply to the entire bill. And yet, when it got written, there's this section just about schools. And this was my bill, first of all, so I wrote this bill. Mm-hmm. And it was, and the nature of what we were trying to do on all these different uses was say, if you're already there, fine, but we're not going to have new ones. And we put this catch-all language in here to say, if you are already there, and it wasn't supposed to be just schools, it was just about anybody, you know, whether it was the golf courses, the model airplane club, like there were several people who got their ox cord that day by my bills. And so we were trying to say, but we're not going to have new uses like this. And so we wanted to be able to allow people to expand. And so for me, at least, whether this bill or the bill we heard about the Kings Valley School, we were not trying to limit current schools to expand. We were just trying to have new schools not be built that primarily serve urban and or suburban people. That if there was going to be a new school in the farm zone, it needed to be for rural people. But my intention, at least, was not to speak to the ability for existing schools to expand. And I don't know why DLCD put that 100 apply. I know it was meant for other things, but applying that as a test of whether or not your school was too big or not was totally contrary to where we were going with this bill originally. So I may have the department come up and talk about that here in a little bit. But I'm very sympathetic. I do want to try and get it done. I don't care if they're connected or not connected. The point was you were there long before 2009, and it doesn't serve the taxpayers or anybody else to have you go find a new location somewhere else that's eligible and have an annex over there where you do your theater and then have to drive everybody back and forth. We'd much rather you just build right there. Now, if your school was not primarily serving rural people, don't plan on doing another one. I would say that. But this one is there, and that's the deal. We're just trying to get schools to build in town when they're aimed at, you know, city people, and in the country when they're aimed at rural people.
That makes perfect sense to me.
Vice Chair Post.
Because you brought it up, Mr. Chair, the Kings Valley situation, mm-hmm. I know there's some difference in that this is somebody wanting to expand where they are, and the Kings Valley was purchased some land that's next door to them to expand. So it's a little bit different story, but is there a way of marrying these two in any way?
Yeah, the amendment that they're referring to, you probably don't know what it is, but it's my amendment, and it's attempting to blend them so it would take care of both situations. The way it does that is by getting rid of the date, the January, that you had to own the land before January 9th. Because again, when we were passing this, it wasn't to say you couldn't even buy more land. It was just for expansion. The goal was take everybody who's already in the door and then close the barn door and let them expand around them if they need to. But I wasn't thinking about trying to force people to have to go build a whole nother school. You know, the Kings Valley people build a whole nother school back inside of Philomath and then have two. The whole point was, let's just not do this again and save farmland for farmland. Vice Chair McLean.
So we're not voting on this today, correct?
Because we don't have this other
amendment.
So
I need to get this out here then. If you're making amendments and you're trying to marry both of these bills, which I think are very different, you were trying to close the door, close the barn door. Don't let the house out on new schools.
Yeah.
There are other conditions that would make it a semi-new school if it is now buying more, you know, land. And there's also the issue about the size, because there's a difference between a building that houses 100 and a building that houses 1,000. And again, this was supposed to be schools that were in rural areas for rural populations. And there are some differences between the two places that we're talking about. So I hope that as amendments are coming together, that we're looking again at what your original goal was, and what we're facing right now, which is 10 years later, what some of the unintended consequences might be that are both positive and negative. And this sounds like a little bit bigger than I thought it was when I walked in. But do you hear what I'm saying?
I do. The only thing I just want to make clear, before 2009, there was no policy about having the schools be for rural people.
I get that.
The law was public or private schools, including all buildings, were allowed on EFU, just plain and simple.
I get it.
And we had all these urban schools buying up land. So then in 2009, we changed it to, no, let's just have all new schools be primarily for rural people. But there are some people who already had schools for urban people who were already out there. So then the question is, do we want them to expand or not? And that's probably kind of what we're debating now. It's whether or not they're for urban or rural people, whether or not they're 100 or not. Doesn't make sense to say, no, you can't expand your current school. And again, when we did this, and I'll have Mary Ann, she's going to be up next anyway, she can comment on how Farm Bureau views some of this, but Farm Bureau and I and Thousand Friends and others went and spent a whole year going through all this. And at the end, we said, none of this is designed to make anybody who's currently doing anything illegal. The goal is to just not have it ever happen again in the future for golf courses, for these things. And so I'm still trying to honor that by not hitting the
Kings Valley School or the Bend School or the Oak Hill School, but fortunately, it seems to put the plug in new schools going out and being built on EFU primarily, but I wasn't thinking it was a good idea to hamstring existing ones, because all the money's already been spent, and there's always families that have been going there for generations, and if they can't ever expand, I don't know what their other option is besides build an annex somewhere else and just bus people around. But we can talk about that more later. Yes, I hear you, though. I hear what you're saying. They are different, but the primary difference seems to be the date, meaning do we want to allow people to buy land and expand versus just use your existing land to expand? Anything else on this for the moment? Okay. Do you want to hear Marianne, or do you want to get to voting?
Oh, no, go ahead.
Yeah, okay, Marianne, do you want to...
And members of the committee, Marianne Cooper here for the Oregon Farm Bureau. I will be very brief. We had actually just wanted to get on the record, and it was earlier on the record that the compliance with 215-1086 was the same process, so that it would still be a conditional use permit, an application made by the school, and the same look at neighboring landowners, because the wording was changed a little bit. And so beyond that, I would say we certainly understand the need for schools to expand and want to make sure that that can occur as long as it's occurring consistent with the current conditional use criteria.
That was another problem with 2919, is it took away
yes.
conditional use, and I'm not in favor of that by any means. So, okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we'll keep talking. Let me close the public hearing on House Bill 3384, and let me open some work sessions. So let's start with Farm to School. Always an exciting day. I've got, what do I have to say here? Let me open a work session on House Bill 2579. We've got some dash threes. This was something that the Speaker and I, she used to be a longtime co-sponsor of this. She didn't want to sign on until she kind of knew how much money she was potentially signing up for, because we had a nice list of things we wanted. So we have in this dash three a more pared down list of requests. It ends up being about $5 million, and we specify how the $5 million would be spent. And we think there's a better chance of that getting through Ways and Means instead of just sending a huge ask down and asking Ways and Means to prioritize. I don't know exactly, I can guarantee $5 million, but I have a pretty good. Oh, there she is. I'm just talking about Farm to School and our pared down finite list that we think will give us a better shot of getting funding in the end. So those are the dash threes.
Okay.
Got it.
So Chair Clem, I move to adopt dash three amendments dated March 28th, 2019.
Vice Chair McClain moves the dash three amendments dated March 28th, 2019. Is there discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so adopted.
And Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2579 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair McClain moves House Bill 2579 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, and hopefully the Speaker will now sign on to it. And let me open a, let me just get through these quickly. We're just gonna take 3 minutes and get through our work session so he can go home sick, if that's cool. All right, let me open a work session on House Bill 2435. Colleagues, this was, remember, the guest ranch statute. We had some feedback from Central Oregon Land Watch requesting that there's some reports made back for ranches that may be approved, otherwise eliminates the sunset. This makes the reporting for any new prospective ranches that would be approved, they'll make reports. And I think that gets, I don't know if they're here, but that gets Land Watch happier. And these are the dash twos.
So, Chair Clem, I move to adopt dash two amendments dated March 26, 2019.
Vice Chair McClain moves the dash two amendments dated March 26, 2019. Is there any discussion?
I guess I have one.
Vice Chair McClain.
So, making sure that they still have to be a working ranch.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Yep. So they'll make reports back. Any new ones would make reports back periodically about how many units they're using, and I forget what all the different parts of the report are, but things about their operations to make sure that they actually still are a working ranch and not just a place to have lunch.
Okay. So Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2435 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
I have not yet called the roll on the amendments. So first the motion to adopt the dash twos, any discussion, any objection?
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2435 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair McLean moves House Bill 2435 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Off to the floor. Oh, gosh. I could ask Rep. Barreto, since I had him do a work group and then forgot to tell him to convene. Maybe he'd want to carry it. If not, I'll figure somebody else out. Okay, let me open a public hearing on House Bill 28, work session on House Bill 2844. Colleagues, you remember this was the Representative David Brock Smith's bill. Representative David Gomberg also had another bill similar that he was hoping we could make sure happened. They're substantially similar. These are the Dash 5 amendments. These include cannabis processing and an allowed activity. They do not include marijuana because your chair is uptight about it still. And those are the Dash 5 amendments.
So, Chair Clem, I move to adopt Dash 5 amendments dated March 25th, 2019.
Vice Chair McLean moves the Dash 5 amendments dated March 25th, 2019. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so adopted. Thank you.
And Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2844 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair McLean moves House Bill 2844 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Would you like to carry it?
I would.
Representative Brock Smith will carry that. We might let Representative Gomberg speak to it if the speaker will allow him to. But okay, let me open a public hearing on House Bill 3024. This is the bill that this is fixing Representative Unger and I's work. We didn't quite get the replacement dwelling language right several years ago. This gets it right so people can replace their dwellings if they burn down, et cetera, whether they had one wall standing or not.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 3024 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Vice Chair McLean moves House Bill 3024 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the bill be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, off to revenue we go. Open a public hearing, work session on House Bill 2577. Dash one amendments. I forgot what they do.
I don't know. It's too weird.
Oh, that's right. So this is the one, colleagues, you may recall, we had a delayed phase-in of annexation for people to get a chance to move or figure out if they want to do something. There are some people who live in residential zones, but they're in residential use, but not in residential zones, and they were unable to take advantage of the delayed phase-in. This fixes that, but there are some people who don't want a delayed phase-in, so the dash ones make it so if a person wants to be annexed more quickly, they can request to be annexed immediately and not wait the 3 years. So that's the dash ones.
Chair Clem, I move to adopt the dash one amendments dated March 21st, 2019.
Vice Chair McLean moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2577. Dated March 21st, 2019. Any discussion? Any objection? So adopted.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2577 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair McLean moves House Bill 2577 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? I just need to state for the record that this bill is just simply codifying a LUBA decision and is not intended to change from that interpretation. And any further discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, to the floor it goes. I'll carry it. I don't think there's a, Senator Roblin was interested in it, but he can carry it over there. Let me open a work session on House Bill 2109. Colleagues, this is another one of my annexation bills. This is the one limiting, this is the one that says that if the island is big enough, the votes are counted as a double majority in cities that have charter amendments. If they're under 100 acres, they're counted as a single majority, combined majority, and if they're over 100 acres or larger, they are counted as a double majority in island annexation law, only in cities where there are charter amendments requiring votes on annexation.
I may have to vote no just because.
I understand.
Okay. All right. Mr. Chair, Clem, I move House Bill 2109 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair McClain moves House Bill 2109 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Helm.
I'll give this a courtesy vote out of the committee. I'm not done thinking about it, and I like annexation bills about as much as you like marijuana bills.
That's a one.
I'm going to have to vote no on this one. Sir. Okay.
Further discussion? Colleagues, my intention is to try and get some limits on the size of islands so they don't become out of hand. So that's the intention here, is to not just have massive, massive islands without people being allowed to vote on them. Further discussion? Okay, seeing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Bossart Davis.
Aye.
Representative Helm.
Aye.
Representative Brock Smith.
Aye.
Representative Williams.
Aye.
Vice Chair McClain.
No.
Vice Chair Post.
Aye.
Chair
Putnam. Aye. And I'll carry that bill. And let me open a work session on House Bill 2980. This is the extending the sunset date for the pesticide use reporting system. This bill goes to Ways and Means after this.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2980 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Vice Chair McClain moves House Bill 2980 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, off to Ways and Means we go. And let me open a public work session on House Bill 2816. Colleagues, this is the task force on IPM, and we have some amendments that came in from Representative Kenny Geyer. We all are thinking about her, of course, and OSU helped work with her to get these amendments adopted, and this represents the cleanup compromise, and we're ready to go. Don't know of any problems with these amendments. Dash ones.
Okay. Chair Clem, I move to adopt the dash one amendments dated March 22nd, 2019.
Vice Chair McClain moves the dash one amendments dated March 22nd, 2019. Any discussion? Any objections? So adopted.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2816 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair McClain moves House Bill 2816 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion? Any objection? That's the end of the work sessions. We wish you well. Feel free to
not miss them.
Oh, you're gonna. Oh, wow.
Oh,
holy
what?
Cow. Then let us open a public hearing on House Bill 2003. Have Speaker Kotek to join us.
I would never leave.
Bringing
that.
Taylor with her and talk about this latest work product. I don't know if it's an amendment yet, but it's new concepts or forthcoming amendments.
For the record, Tina Kotek, State Rep, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, and Speaker of the House. And I'm sorry you're not feeling well, Vice Chair Post. So, but thank you for sticking around. So we are back on House Bill 2003. There is a dash four and a dash five amendment. So if you recall, I was here a couple weeks ago talking about this bill. And I was thinking about it again today because today is Realtor Day in the building. And I was sitting down with some constituent real estate professionals, and they were talking about what's the plan for the state? Where are we going? You know, this was in reference to some of the work we've done. And I was talking about this bill because I think one of the things that we're really struggling with here at the state is knowing where we're going on housing and the lack of data that we have about our needs, what our needs analyses have said or not said, because so few of them have been done or been updated, and then how do we have a strategy to meet them. I think in this committee in particular, we believe in our land use system. We believe in what we have constructed to protect our farmland, to contain growth in an intentional way. We have urban growth boundaries, and we have within our land use system Goal 10. Goal 10 is about housing, and it's probably one of those things that, oh yeah, yeah, when we set this up, we were gonna do all this. But we don't really, we are not as committed to Goal 10 as we could be in this state, and so that's what this bill is about. The first draft, I think I mentioned, was really a little hard to understand. So the dash four amendment is really a complete rewrite. It doesn't change what I thought we were trying to do. It just is a lot easier to follow. And Taylor, our policy director in the speaker's office, has done a section-by-section analysis with the dash four and five amendments for your reading pleasure. So I don't want you to be lost. So we have plenty to read online. I just want to touch on a few things. The goal of the bill with the dash four, let's focus on that, and the dash five was an additional one. But the dash four amendment, which is the rewrite, talks about enhancing local accountability around reaching our goal 10 obligations. And one of the things that I think is a cornerstone piece is to develop a regional housing needs analysis. Now, one of the things I will say is that I think you brought it up last time. Why is it the Department of Administrative Services in this bill? We put that in there because we thought the Office of Economic Analysis, which does a lot of analyses, economic analyses for the state, including some of our housing work, would be a good place to do that. So that's why DAS is referenced. I will note that there has been some concern from the Office of Economic Analysis if they're the right place to do it. Maybe DLCD is the better spot. But right now, the bill with the dash four does reference DAS for the purpose of talking about the Office of Economic Analysis. So I'm open to a different play there. It just seemed that from our perspective, that was the right place to go, but maybe that's not right in terms of their capacity. But we do need to have these regional housing analyses done. It also talks about requiring cities and counties and Metro in particular, to estimate their local housing need over a 20-year period and updating it on a regular basis. I think that's really important. And once you've done that, then have a strategy to reach your goals. I feel like we spend a lot of time talking about things here in the state, but then we're like, well, how do we get there? We do need to have strategies to get there. And if you're going to hear any objections to this bill, it's going to be the timelines are too aggressive. We don't have enough dollars. You know, we agree with your value, but we just can't make this happen. And I have to say, at what point, when do we make this happen? This bill does have $1.5 million attached to the amendment that would help with technical assistance. There would also be additional money that has to go to DLCD to do some of the other work. We're committed to putting some money behind this, and maybe it's only one time, and I understand that, but when are we going to get started on this? When are we going to have this information? We don't know where we're going. We don't need where, how bad the situation is and how we actually plan to solve it. So if we're going to be committed to Goal 10, we have to really embrace this bill, I think. One of the things that's coming out of the bill is some of the provisions in the underlying bill around system development charges. But I want you to know that I'm personally committed to making sure we have a work group in the interim on SDCs. In my conversations with folks who pay SDCs, I think they could use a little bit more oversight and accountability and questioning about what they're for and how they are levied. It has become a significant barrier to housing development, and I think we all have to come back and have that conversation in the interim. So just want to flag that for everyone. The Dash 5 amendment is a little different, but we wanted to also say we support this. I want to thank the Building Codes Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services for coming forward and saying, hey, we could maybe come up with some model template construction plan so people could, you know, get out there and construct quicker and faster if they met all the codes. The problem that DCBS came about was the way the law is that the architects at DCBS who would come up with these model plans would be individually liable if there was a problem with the plans. Mm. And what the Dash 5 does is say the department would be liable if for some reason there's a problem with these model plans and not the individual architects. Because I think we want to encourage this type of innovation where agencies and agency experts can say, here, plop, here's a plan. It beats code. Go build it. And that's what I think DCBS wants to provide, but they need coverage on the liability. The individuals who are doing it should not be held liable. The agency should. So that's what the Dash 5 does. And we would support both the fours and fives getting done as soon as you can and get it down to Ways and Means for putting some money behind it because it's that important. So, and if you have any particular questions, I have Taylor with me. So thank you, colleagues.
Taylor, is your section by section in all this?
Okay, further
any questions? Vice
Chair. Vice Chair.
Sorry, I was going to get there. It's taken me a while. I'd like to be involved in that, just offering my service in that SDC thing. I've been very interested in that. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay.
further? You can stick around for a few minutes if you want to hear other testimony or more questions.
Yeah, we've got five people signed up, so we'll start getting into it.
Great, thank you.
Thank you,
colleagues.
Okay, let me call up Peggy Lynch, Jody Hack, and Gwen Baldwin. And then wish you the best of luck, my friend.
We'll see you in the morning, probably. Okay. Thanks. She's at rest.
So great. Peggy, are you first on the list?
Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. I really don't have a great deal to say today. I was hoping to hear more about how the how the strategy was going to happen to better explain that part of the bill. I did send a notice to each of you individually related to one portion of it regarding the regional analyses and how it calls out the regional solutions areas, which are 11 large areas in the state. I would suspect that you will probably, or the people will want to look at maybe making that smaller regions, since, for instance, one region is Lincoln, Lynn, Lane, and Benton counties. And there are a whole lot of cities within there. And so to be able to do that regional analysis, I think, is maybe problematic. But that simply means that we may need to have more money to be able to do this work. The League loves data. We love data to be able to make good decisions, to see that good decisions are made. We are interested in having the local jurisdictions update their plans with regularity. We have fought for that for a whole lot of years, but it does take, with the advent of Measure 5 and Measure 50 in particular, local jurisdictions simply have not had the money to do the updates that need to be done. So it will mean that the state will need to step up and help with that work. And I think with that, that's probably enough for now until I hear more exactly about how the rest of the bill will work. I'm still not sure I understand what the obligations of local jurisdictions are.
My turn.
Jody.
Chair Clement, members of the committee, for the record, Jody Hack here on behalf of the Oregon Home Builders Association to testify in support of House Bill 2003 with the dash fours and the dash five amendments. First, let me start by saying thank you to Speaker Kotek and her legislative director, Taylor Smiley Wolf, for their efforts, continued efforts, in addressing needed housing supplies across Oregon. While we see that some of the local barrier issues relating to SDC fees are no longer included in the bill, we are looking forward to and appreciate the intent the speaker has regarding moving forward with a much needed work group addressing those issues. The bill does address local barriers as it relates to the intent to appeal local projects, and we're thankful that that language is still included. The bill implements a much needed regional housing needs analysis, inventory of housing stock, and a housing shortage analysis with parameters and timelines. The housing needs analysis and housing shortage analysis and its relation to statewide planning goals related to housing and any rules and policies adopted pursuant to these goals, and ORS 197-295 to 197-314, is very helpful in obtaining much needed data of what we have and what we need to move the housing dial across the state of Oregon. The criteria around a housing production strategy and requires specific actions, including the adoption of measures and policies that the city shall undertake to promote development that addresses the identified housing shortage is also a key element. The creation of financial and regulatory incentives for development of needed housing may need to be flushed out, but we're looking forward to what that may bring. The requirement that metro service districts and local governments be required to demonstrate sufficient buildable lands within a scheduled set by LCDC on or before December 31st, 2019 is a move in the right direction. Prioritizing the housing crisis means that local jurisdictions need funding to implement the needed analysis. Many have not been able to do this work for years. This bill provides for that. I could go on and on, but there's others. Gwen's probably got a whole lot more than I do. But again, just supportive of all the work that's been done with this bill and housing needs across the state. Thank you.
Chair Clem, Vice Chairs McLean, and formerly Post, and members of the committee, Gwen Baldwin here today representing Oregon Smart Growth. We've been in front of you before. We are a coalition of developers and investors and allied professions, and we are really committed to the kind of walkable, livable, communities that Oregon really aspires to. But in order to do that, there are certain things that need to change and need to be focused on. And House Bill 2003 addresses a really central one. And I believe it's an essential part of a comprehensive housing strategy that I fundamentally believe this legislature, this committee, has to be a part of. This is the time. We have a housing crisis. You cannot deal with a crisis without supply. And the truth of the matter is there are many bills this session that touch on housing and pieces of housing, and each genuinely trying to get at an angle to try to improve the housing available and the cost of housing in this state. But 2003, with the -4 and -5 amendments, is one of the few that can truly move the dial. Creating a consistent methodology to determine regional housing needs, executing a regular schedule of measuring what types of housing is needed, and then assisting local communities in developing strategies, in creating the incentives and removing the barriers that each community needs, is a unique combination. These amendments reflect, I think, really important work and discussions with the stakeholders by the Speaker and her staff to create a more flexible bill for local jurisdictions while still maintaining accountability for statewide planning goals that have been on the books for decades. The bill also provides support to local jurisdictions, really important, that are having trouble developing their housing strategies by providing them both technical assistance to find, identify issues and ways to resolve them, and also resources. I agree with my colleague Jody that it is too bad that the audit framework for SDCs is no longer in the -4s, but I'm confident that the conversation will happen in the interim, and we are eager to participate. What I really want to urge the committee to consider today is that House Bill 2003 is a good bill. It's a needed bill, and it's one that deserves this committee and this legislature's support. Please do not let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Oregon needs to measurably move the dial on housing supply in addition to the other pieces of comprehensive housing approaches. Without additional supply, we are guaranteed to have increased housing costs sooner than later. Again, I want to thank all the work that the Speaker has put into this, as well as Taylor Smiley Wolf, yeoman's work evening and weekends. And I urge your do pass recommendation for 2003 with the -4s and -5s. Thank you.
Any questions for this panel? I've got, please, yeah, go ahead. So I've got Peter Kanagian, Eric Kanzler, and then, Madam Speaker or Taylor, I've got a question I think that's going to be for one of you. So if you can stick around through these two, that would be great. But we'll get through Peter first, then Eric.
Chair Clamp, members of the committee, thanks for this opportunity to address you on House Bill 2003. The intent of this is good. I mean, my concern is that it's only addressing one piece of the issues that we need to be looking at.
You need to say your name for the record, Peter.
Peter Kanagian, Benton County. It's only one of the issues we need to be looking at. It's not looking far enough out down the road, not looking 10 generations out. Too often, we're very focused on the here and now, and what's happened in the next 20 years. And that's one of the big failures of our land use planning system, that it's, you know, we have that mandated 20-year buildable supply. And legislation like this should have companion legislation that looks at the long-term current growth rate of our state, where it's projected to go, and it needs to ask the question, is that where we want to go? And if the answer to that is not yes, then we need to look at finding creative ways to stabilize our growth in this state so that future generations out, not just my grandkids, but my great-great-great-great-grandkids, have a livable state. And I just think there needs to be more done than just looking at a housing analysis. Thank you.
Eric?
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Eric Kanzler representing the city of Bend. I was here at the first public hearing And I think commenting on the fact that for many sessions we have talked about the importance of talking about Goal 10, but really hadn't gotten down to the business of doing anything about it. And House Bill 2003 clearly does that. And we thank the Speaker for bringing it forward then, and we'll thank her again now. The base bill had a number of elements that we saw as very problematic. All of those elements are out of the bill. We saw a number of elements that have significant merit. All of those merits remain in the bill. What we see is vastly improved, largely implementable. We still have largely technically oriented feedback at this point, but see the bill as more than moving in the right direction. So I'm not here yet to give a specific position on the bill, but to continue to suggest that it continue to be worked. We would support it advancing for that purpose and believe that it's very close. So thank you, and be happy to take any questions.
Questions for Eric? Vice Chair McLean.
So my question is this. You're in for the goal. You're in for the goal of talking about and doing something about Goal 10.
Chair Clem, Representative McLean, we are in for both of those, absolutely. I think largely by virtue of the fact that when we did our last urban growth boundary expansion, the city of Bend had quite a bit of catch-up to do. We had a legacy of single-family detached communities that left us at a disadvantage for meeting future needs. And as part of getting our UGB expansion approved, we had to push the envelope on the housing needs analysis and all of the related elements of the analysis. So we've done work that is far above and beyond what we've done in the past, and we see it as a crucial element of meeting future housing needs, yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, follow up.
A follow up is for Peter. You said you wanted us to look at other things. One of the things that came to my mind was not just how many houses we need in the urban areas, but also rural reserves. And so I was wondering what would be some of the ideas that you came up with.
For rural reserves specifically?
Or that was just my idea. I just gave you an example that we need to know what it takes for a lot of different things besides housing. And so I agree with you that we need to do longer planning than 20 years. So my question was, what other example did you have of something that we needed to look at that was longer than 20 years or different than housing?
Chair Clem, Vice Chair McLean, I think we need to look at quality of life, our environment, what's it gonna be like when our population doubles again? And really seriously ask the question, is that a wise path to go down?
Okay.
And you know, we just don't do that in this state. We're very good about some things, but we're not good about that long range and trying to decide if we really want to go down that road of packing as many people in the state as want to come.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Okay, thank you.
So
my question comes from the little, I've got to find it now, the little walkthrough guide. And I'm trying to figure out where, what did I do here? Sorry, I'll find it in a moment. There's a section that talks about LCDC's enhanced authority expands. So it's under, it's on page, I think that's page 2. And it is the second bullet from the bottom, and it says expands LCDC's statutory authority to issue an order requiring local jurisdiction to amend its comp plan or land use regulations to comply with statewide land use planning goals, including Goal 10. And I'm trying to figure out where in the dash 4s that is kind of embodied so I can read what exactly we're talking about.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Taylor Smiley Wolf. I'm the Speaker's Policy Director. In section 11, so page 21 of the dash 4 amendments, you can just see that what was added to LCDC's list of options for moving forward within enforcement action is sub 13, a city is not making satisfactory progress in taking actions listed in its housing production strategy. So that becomes one of the reasons with which they can move forward with an enforcement order.
And I don't know if you know this or not, the department might be here if, in case you don't, but
how far could an enforcement order go? Like, for example, if we said we're short 100,000 units, could they say, move your UGB out to fix it and just bypass the rest of the normal UGB expansion process? Or is that not something an order can go that far?
It might be a better question for the agency, but it's my understanding that they have the ability to update land use regulations or amend comprehensive plans on behalf of a local jurisdiction.
Parker, do you think you could be of any help if I call you up here, or do we need technical people? Even more tech? Yeah, we need more tech. Okay, I'll take my questions offline and get some more information. I just want to be sure that if we're empowering LCDC, once they get the answer back to, for example, a land use regulation could mean your urban growth boundary, if they have the authority to order an urban growth boundary expansion, that's a pretty major policy change. I want to make sure we're fully discussing before we do that.
And Chair Clem, members of the committee, so it does not add additional enforcement authority around their ability to amend comprehensive plans or land use regulations. It simply lists not making satisfactory progress on their housing production strategy as one of the triggers for being able to use the authority that they currently have.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, that helps. Okay. Further, Representative Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not so much a question, but going through the testimony today, I expected to get testimony from our friends at Metro. And I expected that testimony might be to defend the way they do their housing needs analysis now, which is extraordinarily sophisticated. And they may not like to blow their own horn on that, but it truly is. And that leads me to wonder whether we would be giving the role to the right state entity to crunch the numbers. Because this is not just an economic analysis. It is also a deep planning analysis and decisions made about what types of lands can go into a model that is suitable for estimating how much density can go in an urban area to start with. And I would hate to require any of our state agencies to start from ground zero on this. And I'll just state my preference now that it is for DLCD. I think they have a better chance of getting it done quicker, faster, and better earlier.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative. Thank you for the, Mr. Chair and Representative Helm, for the question. Certainly open to that. I think we want to make sure that, because the way, for example, on the dash four on page 3, it talks about the Oregon Department of Administrative Services, which would be the Office of Economic Analysis, in coordination with DLCD and as well as the Housing and Community Services Department to do this work. If we have some different combination of that where DLCD is the lead and the other two are in collaboration, I think that would be okay, and we'd want to make sure that whichever agency has it, they have the resources to do the work, and we certainly expect to see a fiscal from somebody on that piece. I also want to make sure that, honestly, that there is political support and commitment when a regional housing analysis gets done, that people stand behind it and don't get, you know, swayed by, you know, what we know will come up from politics of doing a housing analysis. But our people are moving here, right? And we have a land use system. We have to make this all work. So I am open to changing that. We just went with this at the moment. But again, you know, we have a couple more days if people want to, you know, rejigger that. But we want to make sure whoever's doing it has the resources to do it as well.
And one follow-up, Chair Clement, Representative Helm. So just to be clear, the regional housing needs analysis is separate and exploratory, so it's functionally a study that would be done and then reported back to the legislature on the viability of potentially moving towards a regional estimation model. The regular updates of the housing needs analysis occur under the current structure. There's just funding and then a schedule with which to do them more regularly.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Mr.
And
Chair
members. We're set for the 4th, I think, for 4s and 5s. Anybody else knows of more amendments? Tell us quickly. Okay, let me open a public hearing on House Bill 3372, beef and lamb. We tried to get this done the other day. I just couldn't manage the time well enough.
Representative Brocksmith, do you want to talk beef and lamb? Ivan, you were on my list, patiently waiting in the back the whole entire meeting to talk about beef and lamb. Why don't you join us, Ivan, now? Representative Brocksmith, do you want to talk a little bit about it from there?
Or? Sure. So, let me pull up the paper here, I'm sorry.
3372.
My staff did not give me the 3372 folder, but I am
just a folder with nothing in it.
I have other folders on the other bills that I'm associated with in the committee. So this is the bill that we've been working with ODA on, and Lori can come up as well and discuss it. And I appreciate the chair for the time and for scheduling the work session. Unfortunately, there's some risk involved with the possibility of having interstate or having just a statewide USDA inspection program. ODA was looking into it, and you probably remember, Mr. Chair, about 6 years ago, with an inspection program through the Talmadge-Aiken Act. And that Talmadge-Aiken Act, it just didn't materialize because there was basically five or six smaller processors around the state that needed some help financially with upgrading their infrastructure to be able to process. And then with ODA personnel being certified through the USDA to inspect, they could then do that. And with a scenario that at one processing facility, they'd inspect on Mondays and so forth. And so there needs to be some resources involved with this piece of legislation. It's something that I'd like to tee up for the in the 20 session so that we can be ready to possibly having a funding component with it in the 2021 session. The problem is, if I can identify that, which I should have started with, is a lot of the larger processors are centrally located. For example, the folks down in Coos Bay or cattle ranchers down in Brookings have to travel all the way to Springfield and Mohawk's Meats to have their cattle processed and have it USDA certified, and then it has to come all the way back to sell locally. I have some of the best lamb that is grown in Oregon. On the Wall Ranch, just there in Langlois, yet a few miles down the road at the local grocery store, when I go buy lamb, it comes from New Zealand. So we're looking at the possibility of being able to have some smaller USDA certified facilities with ODA USDA certified inspectors that could come out and
mobile ones.
No, not mobile. The ability, because you still have to have the USDA facility up to USDA code, and the ability, no, to have the ODA inspectors be able to move and not. The cost associated with USDA inspection comes with having the permanent USDA employee there
all the time. Yeah.
And so with the Talmadge-Aiken, ODA could have and does have certified inspectors that could, you know, show up on Mondays and Fridays.
I see.
And so forth. And so the component that's missing is some sort of help with the processing facilities that do exist to come up with the U.S., to come up to code. And so that is where I'd like to get the ducks in a row, and I've talked to ODA about doing so, and be prepared again in 2020 for a 2021 ask that will have a ways and means component, so that we can possibly get some grants or low interest loans to re-identify the facilities that ODA had identified in the past.
make those connections, have allow ODA some time to make those connections again, so that we're prepared to move forward. So that our because I have a processor that's just south of the game park, for example, a Mobile Ranch Butchering, that we were able to get a $50,000 USDA grant. I believe you might maybe remember this in 17 when I discussed this, to do a feasibility study. They currently do a mobile operation. The problem is the mobile operation of butchering can't be sold commercially. It can only be, you know, it's only for subscription or personal use. Mm-hmm. And so, again, we have some of the best grass-fed beef at Six's there. Commissioner John Sweet's nephew, Jake Pastana, or excuse me, the Pastanas run it, Joe Pastana. And yet he has to have it processed all the way in Springfield and all the way back. And so the additional cost of that is quite extensive. So again, appreciate the hearing. I appreciate the possible work session.
Need it.
And we aren't gonna need it. As I discussed with ODA late last week, we're going to, I mean, we could move it. We would need amendments. It would need, and then it would need a different fiscal, and it's not something that that I think we haven't made the conversations or the connections with those processors around the state to be prepared to pick this up this biennium. So I just assume, appreciate the opportunity to tee it up, and it will be back as long as I am.
Okay, but let's see if Ivan can persuade us somehow. We got to do it right now.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Ivan Molesky with Friends and Family Farmers, and I want to thank Representative Brocksmith for bringing this idea up. Recognize that there's some complexities, but as a number of you know, we do listening sessions with farmers and ranchers all over the state. We've been doing them since 2009. In 2018, I think we had over 200 producers participate in 19 different meetings, and of the primary issues that came up, the number two issue around the state, particularly in more remote parts of the state, was the lack of access to small farm meat processing infrastructure. Oregon has actually seen a very significant decline in USDA-inspected slaughter and processing facilities that serve smaller producers. It's my understanding that there used to be 300 or so Oregon meat processing facilities that 300 or so have closed in the last 35 years, and there's only 13 USDA inspected facilities remaining. And in order to sell retail, you know, whether you're selling retail at a grocery store, to direct to consumer, to farmer's market, you want to go to a restaurant, wholesale to schools, you have to be USDA inspected. So you're really limited in what your options are by the lack of this processing. And the lack of processing means that oftentimes producers, as Representative Brocksmith noted, have to travel hundreds of miles or many hours to get their animals to where they need to be processed. Sometimes you also have to wait, depending on your species, 6 to 8 months to get processing time. So you combine all those factors and it adds significant cost and time for producers who are already operating on very small margins, but who are offering, frankly, some of the best, highest quality meat products, not only in Oregon, probably the world. So if we can somehow create a pathway for some sort of state license or state inspected processing of beef and lamb to be sold within the state of Oregon, that's going to open up economic opportunities for many smaller producers. And it's also going to provide greater access to locally processed meat. My one friendly amendment I might throw in here is to say we should expand this to include swine and goat as well. So that's beef, lamb, swine, and goat. So we understand that the federal rules can be very complicated. There's work to be done here. We support the underlying thrust of this bill, and hopefully that whether it's creating this ODA inspection process or perhaps technical and financial support, we can help reverse the trend and get more of these small-scale processors up and running. Thank you.
Representative Bossart Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of a mother of three budding hog farmers, I appreciate the additional of swine. And then also, Representative Brocksmith, I think the Anderson Ranch provides some of the best lamb in the state. Was going to put that
I won't deny
on record.
You got it there, Representative.
And Ivan, you said 300 closed in how many years?
Chair Clem, Representative Boschart Davis. It's my understanding that some 300 of this processing facility have closed in Oregon in the last 35 years.
35 years. Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Capital Press, so I'll have to trust my sources here.
Can you opine? Is it a regulatory issue? Can you opine on that at all?
I will opine. I suspect that it's a variety of factors. I think much as there's been consolidation in production into larger operations, there's probably been some consolidation in the processing infrastructure as well. It costs a lot of money to keep these facilities up to standards, and so they need investment. It's a bit of a chicken and egg problem. As you lose smaller producers, you lose the customers for these facilities as well. So, and sometimes when there's some challenges with small producers, they can't necessarily provide the year-round throughput that every facility needs. You get a lot of bunching up seasonally. So there are some challenges. Oregon State University has a great resource in the Niche Meat Processors Assistance Network that I might recommend as a great group of folks to have consulting during the process of moving this down the road. But you know, some of the challenges, the lack of producers, sometimes it's a lack of processing, sometimes a little bit of both in it, and it leads to a spiral where we're losing more and more of these small facilities.
Mr. Chair, follow up?
Yeah, let me just read one quote from the director of the Niche Meat Processor Assistance Network. It is a brutal job to go out and kill things all day long. It's not the kind of thing younger people are interested in doing. So part of it is we got to train people on how this works. It's a generational challenge, maybe.
As a follow-up comment to that, I was going to say my 16-year-old daughter has announced she wants to be a butcher. Oh. Right? So I find that interesting, and Representative, I'd love to work with you on this further. And then also just in our area, Stanton's closed, right 2 miles down the road from my place. And so I see that there's maybe a lack of interest in the next generation. Things have to be upgraded. It might be too expensive. I think there's probably regulatory issues in that as well. So I think it definitely is an issue being on the, my husband's on the FFA and 4-H county board, and they have a lack of being able to get enough of these butchers to provide even for their local FFA and 4-H fair. So I think this is definitely an issue that I would love to be taken up in the future, and I'd be happy to work on that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm reading this article that was in 2016 about the decline, and one of the things we did, I think it was probably you and I, Ivan, I don't remember who, somebody worked with me. I remember you might have brought him to me. It was a young guy from Tangent, and he needed his poultry exemption, and so there had been a federal change, I don't know if it was in the Farm Bill or something, that allowed for states to have under a certain amount of bird without a USDA inspection. We adopted it.
For the
and,
Jinx?
What's that?
Jinx Hatchery?
I can't remember. It's been like 10 years now. But we adopted this ability for a certain amount of birds to be slaughtered and sold on farm without having to get a USDA license. And from that time, there has been a pretty large increase, because what he was describing was his first, I can't remember how long, but his first X amount of sales were done illegally, is basically what he said on the record, because he said there's no way to do it except illegally. And so we need a program that allows us to grow to a certain size. And then once you get over, I think now it's 20,000 birds a year, then you have to get your USDA license. But there has to be that incubator period where you grow your volume to the point where then it makes sense to get USDA license. And he might have even been USDA licensed by that time when he testified. But because we made cottage industry exemptions that were allowed under federal law, aren't always allowed under federal law, but if they are, then we were able to incubate some of the growth, because the regulatory costs can be really high. But when we're dealing with small farms, we felt the risk wasn't actually that high, but the cost was really high. So, but I don't know if we can do that in other meats, or if it's just poultry that allows you to have those kind of cottage industry exemptions.
ODA says you, Chair, thank you. ODA says you can't.
Cannot.
Unfortunately,
it's just poultry. Or you want to come up, Lauren, and join in the conversation?
Lauren was like, I thought we were out of here.
And I felt like 9 years ago we tried mobile slaughtering bill, and I just feel like I keep repeating myself. Every 5 or 6 years we revisit this.
So Chair Clem and committee members, Lauren Henderson, I'm the Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. This is one of those issues that, for the most part, I have never found disagreement that this is not a need in Oregon. It is. And it continues to come up. You're referencing the adoption of the 1,000-bird exemption.
1,000-bird, not 20,000-bird.
Right, which was already in place for USDA. We just needed to adopt that and allow that, which we did, which Ivan was a big help in doing that. And that has been, I think, for the most part, very successful. If I could, Rep. St. Brock-Smith, you did a great job of describing, I think, the issue along with Ivan's testimony, but let me take you a little bit deeper to tell you what we're up against.
Thank you.
The Federal Meat Inspection Act is controlled in a very concrete box that the states are not allowed to tinker with. The states have to fit into that box. And so the states are allowed to do three things. One is have USDA inspected facilities, which we have. We have 13, you said, Ivan, 13. And then there is the full-on state meat inspection program. Oregon used to have a state meat inspection program in the 70s, but it was discontinued by the legislature because it needed a pretty hefty general fund subsidization to make it work. And because of budget cuts in those days, in the 70s, it was ended. There are 34 states in the country that have some form of either USDA state meat inspection program or what Rep. St. Brock-Smith referred to as the Talmadge-Aiken Act, which is somewhere in between USDA's inspected facilities and the state full-on state meat inspection program. And what that allows is our staff to be trained by USDA, and when an inspection is needed, they don't have to be there 5 days a week all the time. We can set up schedules, but when our staff would be there, they would be as though they were a USDA inspector. We pursued that and have done that a couple of times, and it always comes down to one problem. The federal act requires that anything the states do, it has to be or equal to the USDA program. So that's been an issue with our facilities, particularly the smaller ones, is having the capital to invest in their facility to make it or equal. I will just say that we did a study in 2008 and revisited this, I don't know, 6 years ago with the Oregon Food Bank, because we thought there was an opportunity to see if we could get approval from the federal government to do the Talmadge-Aiken Act, because there was a need for, I think Rep. Bouchard Davis, you brought up FFA and 4-H. There was a desire in the county fairs to have people who would like to buy an animal from the kids be able to have it processed and stay local to help food insecure issues in those rural parts of the country. So the bottom line is we probably should pursue, if the legislature is interested, the Talmadge-Aiken Act. It doesn't necessarily require specific legislative authority because it's a cooperative agreement with the Federal Meat Inspection Act. It would involve resources, and then we'd have to figure out how to get the facilities that to that or equal standards so that USDA would buy off on it.
No, I just want to thank Lauren for all his work in this area. Is so knowledgeable, and lastly, we just need to be careful as we move forward to make sure that we aren't putting pressure on the existing USDA facilities. And we need to work with them as partners in the expansion of this program with ODA as the USDA inspectors, because we don't want to push them in an area where there could be financial challenges with them as well. So I appreciate it again, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the discussion and look forward to bringing them back to your committee next year so that we can tee up the bill and be ready for the financial piece and have more of the facilities identified in 2021.
Vice Chair McClain.
The niche that I thought was filling some of that need between 70s and now in your scenario was what you were calling like the meat packers or the local lockers or the mobile, the mobile killing slaughter vans, whatever you want to call them, that came out to the farms, but you couldn't sell to the public. You could only sell to, like you're talking, family or folks who wanted to buy a half a beef or half a lamb or something like that. And whose rules are they under? Because that's what we used for our 4-H'ers and everybody else.
Chair Clem, Vice Chair McLean, those are USDA's federal meat inspection rules, but there's those. That's an exempt activity.
Of what?
It's exempt.
Oh, okay.
If it's for personal use.
Yes.
Okay.
The one thing I didn't really think I realized, or maybe it happened since 2009, I went and looked it up. It was 2011 when we did the poultry bill, which it's been, I feel like I'm getting very old because it's been a long time. Ivan still looks fresh, but I feel very old. But there's this small enterprise USDA exemption that allows up to 20,000 birds annually without an on-site inspector, and those can be sold in grocery stores and restaurants. But is that, has that always been around? Or do we have to adopt it? It says there's one in Wilhelmina, so we must not have to adopt it.
Chair Clem, that's always been around, and I do not believe you have to adopt anything. That is part of the USDA exemptions.
Is it just poultry, though?
Yes.
So you couldn't have an equivalent program yet? Well, that might be something for our federal delegation to lobby on at some point.
There haven't been incidences of any problems with our poultry exemption so far. I'm sure I would have heard about it if there was.
Not that I'm aware.
Representative Schaffler, I think, at the time. Oh, no, that was the Farm Direct flaming peppers, and he called it something about people making jam in their bathtub and selling it at the farmer's market. We had one no vote, and there's never been any foodborne illness from any of our bills so far.
Chair Clem, if I could just add one more thing to follow up with Representative Brock Smith, and this is an important point. The idea is not to locate facilities within close proximity to the current USDA plants. The idea was to fill in Oregon so that someone could, within a 50-mile radius, take that animal and have it processed. And so that was the effort that we were working on at that point in time several years ago. And I think that it still would still be an interested path to move forward to help lessen those distances.
Okay, very good conversation. Thank you, Representative Brock Smith, for bringing this one forward.
Thank you.
And we've got to do orchard grass. Let me close the public hearing on House Bill 3372. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3401. Representative Bossart Davis, are you going to say anything about it? No? Okay, Roger Beyer, come tell us about orchard grass and the abolishment of this commission.
Soon. Thank you, Chair Clem, and members of the committee. I recognize I'm the only thing keeping you from being not here, so I'll be very brief. Thank you, Representative Bossart Davis, for introducing this bill on our behalf and using a priority bill to do so. This bill is mirrored after a bill, Chair Clem, that you passed in 2011. Imagine that, where we abolished two commissions at that time.
Oh, yeah.
It was the Highland Bentgrass Commission and the Small Grains Commission. This is just a reflection of the ever-changing world of Oregon agriculture, in that as products change and markets change, the what producers grow will shift. And unfortunately, in the commission world, the only way to get rid of a commission or to change a commission is to come to you, the legislature, and have it done by your action, because the commissions are products of the legislature. So the orchard grass growers have just continued to reduce in number, and while it's a very important crop for those who grow them, there's just not many people left growing it. But the work they do is still very important in the research and the marketing of their product. But what's happened here recently, and why we had this introduced as a priority bill and trying to get it with an emergency clause on the bill, is that the administrator of the Orchard Grass Commission has decided to resign effective the end of this fiscal year, and they don't have enough money in their coffers to hire a new administrator. So what they've asked to do, and in all of this, you'll see a letter from the Orchard Grass Commission and a letter from the Tall Fescue Commission, is the Orchard Grass Commission approached the Tall Fescue Commission to see if they would take on the role of assessing the orchard grass producers and doing the work of the commission as a combined commission. And the Tall Fescue Commission agreed to do so. And therefore, we have the bill and all the language in sections 2 through 6 of the bill in order to make that happen, so that the Tall Fescue Commission will start assessing. They'll take over the records, they'll take over the duties, and they'll close up the Orchard Grass Commission, and it'll be hopefully be seamless. Section 7 of the bill is also, there is a place in statute where Orchard Grass Commission is, it sets the maximum assessment. We had to eliminate that. And then finally, I'll just speak to Section 8 of the bill. The other issue that we decided to include in this bill is that many of these small commissions use contract administrators or independent contractor for administration rather than having state employees as their administrators. And we just wanted to clarify, while we had a bill here in dealing with this issue, that it was okay for them to hire a contract administrator, and that we outlined what the duties that are allowed for that administrator to do. It's important to note that the administrator cannot do discretional functions. There's discretionary functions. Those are left to the commission. The commission has to decide, but we want to make sure it's clear that the administrator can do anything, things like scheduling meetings and paying, you know, writing checks. We laid it out in the bill, processing payments and or any other task or project assigned by the commission. That's what that section does. And then finally, there seemed to be somewhat of a conflict in the current statute, in that if you look at subsections 3 and subsection 5 of the current law, and this is, I'm looking at ORS 5763306, it very specifically says these contract administrators are not employees. But subsection 4, which we are asking to be deleted, says that for purposes of these commissions, they could be considered employees. It says the commission could be an employer of these contractors, and that seemed to be a conflict with itself. So we are just asking that subsection to be deleted. So, Mr. Chair, there's no note in opposition to the bill. I'd ask that you move it forward, and we can continue with this important work. Thank you.
Okay. Questions for Roger?
Oh, I forgot. There is a -1 amendment. We requested a -1 amendment to further refine the duties of the contract administrator in subsection 1 of section 8, and it should be here hopefully by schedule for work session.
Okay, that's the -1 coming.
Okay. If I remember right, it's a two-word change, just it's a very technical amendment.
Okay. And any further questions? Okay, the only comment I will make, yes, we did abolish some commissions in 2011, but my first time abolishing a commission was 2009, the Oregon Friar Commission. Huh? And God rest his soul, Mike Dewey brought it to me, and then in the Senate, he and his business partner dressed up as chickens, and I expect you and or Representative Bossard Davis to dress up as a blade of orchard grass by the time it gets to the Senate. Okay, and anything else for the good of the record?
I
had to look it up to see if it's feasible. And I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3401 and adjourn the committee.
Do you want to know people grow it agriculturally on purpose?